the President of the United States.
If your name is Sam Rayburn, you lift your gavel and rap for order as a joint session of senators and representatives, many of them bitter foes of the man on the rostrum, cheer him madly. Because like most Americans, they are angry, frightened, and confused. And he is the President of the United States.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, the United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. With confidence in our armed forces, with the unbounding determination of our people, we will gain the inevitable triumph. So help us God.
1 month from today will mark the 84th anniversary of the Japanese bombing of Pearl Harbor, and the reverberations are still being felt in many ways, even though there are many who were not even alive in 1941. Dr. Alan Austin introduces some of his students at Misericordia University to an illustrated memoir by Nisei artist Mine Okubo, and that work was published in 1946 by Columbia University Press. Citizen 13660 is the earliest first-person book-length account of the U.S. internment camps for Japanese Americans during World War II. Okubo produced an estimated 2,000 portraits of camp life in a range of styles and materials, including ink, charcoal, and gouache, while she was imprisoned at camps in California and Utah, with 200 or so in her memoir. As the Densho Encyclopedia explains, long after Citizen 13660's initial publication, Okubo continued to play an instrumental role in curating its meaning, most influentially by framing it in the last decades of her life as aligned with the politics of the Japanese-American redress movement. Significant in terms of the contemporary interpretation of her memoir, Okubo penned a preface for the 1983 University of Washington Press reissue, updating Citizen 13660's meaning for subsequent generations of readers, underscoring the untold hardships, sadness, and misery that all those who were evacuated and interned had experienced as a result of official wartime policies of mass removal and incarceration. That from the Densho Encyclopedia. Mine Okubo is an artist attempting to keep the memories and experiences of those who were interned in America in the 1940s alive for generations in the future, as we just heard. The Pauli Friedman Gallery at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre, is currently hosting an exhibition titled Resilience. In 1942, in response to the bombing of Pearl Harbor by Japanese forces, President Franklin D. Roosevelt signed into law Executive Order 9066. The law ordered the forced imprisonment of all Japanese Americans living on the west coast of the United States, which had the second largest population of Japanese people living outside of Japan, told from the point of view of Sansei. Third-generation Japanese-Americans, Resilience, a Sansei Sense of Legacy, is an exhibition of eight artists whose work reflects on the effect of FDR's Executive Order 9066 as it resonated from generation to generation. The exhibition will run until Sunday, December 15th. And we had a visit from Dr. Lalaine Bagolin Little, adjunct professor of arts, film, and music at Misericordia, and she is gallery director. And also from Dr. Alan Austin, who is professor of history at Misericordia, and he specializes in 20th century U.S. history, immigration, and popular culture. And they did stop in at the WVIA studios to talk with us about the exhibition and how it has come to Misericordia.
As you know, I try to bring exhibitions that highlight the work of our faculty. And I knew Alan, of course, was working with the history of Japanese Americans in the United States, particularly the incarceration. And so when I reserved this exhibition, it was 5 years ago. So not even an inkling of what was to come. And I'm so grateful now that this came at that time because it filled up very quickly. All of the tour slots filled very quickly. And this is through the Mid-America Alliance. And so we brought it. And once you start unpacking the works that are in the exhibition, the scale of what these artists created is so overwhelming, depicting things like the numbers of people that were incarcerated, the devastation of families, especially in California. And so the exhibition, again, is called Resilience, Sansei's Sense of Legacy. Sansei referring to the third generation of Japanese Americans after this time of incarceration.
And eight artists.
Eight artists. Seven of them are descended from Japanese Americans from the United States. One is descended from Peruvian Japanese.
And the work that is on exhibit then from various time periods within 20 years, how old would some of them be or how fresh?
Most of them were created around 2017. So these are fairly new works and the show has been traveling for about 5 years.
And Alan, we turn to you often because you have such a sense of history and American history and the way that America has welcomed or not others to this land. When you had a chance to know it was coming as a show, when you walked into the gallery, what did you feel?
It's a very powerful moment, I think, to walk into the gallery. I'm so proud that Misericordia is hosting this. I can't thank Lane enough for bringing an exhibit like this to Misericordia. But there are three installations that hang from the ceiling. And I guess you might describe them as they feel almost like a mountain of the tags that Japanese Americans were given as they were processed, right? As you prepared for moving, you would go and you would register your family, and your family would be reduced to a number. And that number would be sort of what defined you through the camp experience, or at least how the government tried to define you through the camp experience, because certainly Japanese Americans resisted that kind of diminishment in lots of ways. So there are three of the different camps, and there's a tag for every person who was sent to the camp. And the one that strikes me most is that we happened to get the Tule Lake mountain of tags. Tule Lake was the segregation camp that, as the government tried to sort out what it defined as loyal versus disloyal, despite the fact, by the way, that the FBI and the Office of Naval Intelligence both had done studies before the war that said the Japanese American community was not a security threat in any way. But as they tried to sort through with this really awful questionnaire of loyalty that's also in the exhibit, those that answered quote unquote wrong to those were sent to Tule Lake. And so to imagine each one of those tags as a person, I think, is a really staggering kind of processing that we ought to do. I brought a couple of sections of my survey class to see it. And I think for them as well, trying to imagine the individuality in this sort of mass processed experience, it just, those tags, I don't think I'll ever fully get out of my mind. It's just incredibly powerful.
And the artist then was able to create, through the amassing of the tags, an experience that would overwhelm us.
Exactly, yes. So these are replicas, but they look antiqued. So they're a bit wrinkled, crinkled, And the artist had taken pains to put individual signatures of the names at the top and then the name of the camp at the bottom of them. So when the students come in and see it, they see these masses of, it looks like leaves on a tree, and they hang from the gallery about 9 feet. So it's from floor to ceiling practically. And there are three of them, and it just gives you a sense of the mass. And then when you look at each tag is individual. It's different. So you can sense that these are individual people that have been, that this has been done to.
And my students in those classes had had the opportunity to look at some documentary photography that was done of Japanese Americans in process as they're on their way to the camps, taken by photographers like Dorothea Lange. So some very, very important photographers doing some very important documenting of American history at that moment. But so many of those pictures focus on families and often kids with the tags on their jackets. And so the photographs really capture, I think, the juxtaposition between a number and a human being in a really moving way. And so I think, especially in conjunction with looking at the photography of somebody like Lange and then stepping into an exhibit like this, it's just even more powerful.
When you say like leaves, Lane, we know that much of the Japanese way of creating art would be to honor trees, and whether it be in the gardens or even bonsai, and then the irony of that. What other traditional Japanese mediums are these artists working in and then undercutting what we might expect?
Yes, that's a great question, because the Japanese artists, or Japanese American artists and Japanese Peruvian artists that worked on this show, brought in a little bit of the traditional techniques with this modern sensibility. So one of the works that's in the gallery are a set of three kimonos that the artist has cut pieces out of and honored each of those diminishments from those pieces by putting them in a ceramic bowl, ceramic also being a traditional Japanese medium, in form of almost an altar. So if you go into a Japanese home, you'll see an altar space for the ancestors. And so they honor these pieces that have been taken away. So these kimono, by the time they have all these pieces have been taken out, they look almost skeletal. And they're hanging on the wall from a bamboo rod. And then the ceramic bowls themselves, one of them is done in kintsugi style, where it's been taken apart but mended together, with the seams having gold in the seams so that you can see where that bowl has been healed.
And that mending is such an important part of the Japanese American experience. The resilience that's mentioned in the exhibit is part of that too. But we have to remember how incredibly traumatic this experience was for Japanese Americans, most of whom saw themselves as Americans, who understood themselves as enjoying basic and fundamental constitutional rights. And having those taken away, it has literally been a project generations in the making to come to grips with and find some healing in response to the violence that was done against their community starting in 1942.
Where is Tule Lake?
It's in California.
And how was the experience of those incarcerated there different from the other camps?
Right. So there's heightened surveillance. There's a larger sort of prison within the prison facility that's being run to where you put the most, with the ones you deemed most dangerous. But there's this beautiful moment in the exhibit. So there's a loyalty questionnaire that's shared by the government in 1943 that's trying to sort Japanese Americans. And it asks them a series of very unfair questions that put them in kind of a no-win position. And those who answered the questions, quote unquote, wrong, end up in Tule Lake facing this increased surveillance.
And are there examples of individuals who came out of the camps and that made art as well?
Oh, absolutely. I often teach Mine Okubo's Citizen 13660, which is her firsthand account. So it's ink and paper drawings that she did while she was in Topaz, which is a camp in Utah, and kind of chronicling the everyday life. And when I teach it, I try to help the students see the juxtaposition between the title, which is, again, reducing her to that number that was on her tag, and the way that she creates real individual lives inside the camp. It is a strikingly beautiful and very quietly subversive recounting of what was done to Japanese Americans.
You mentioned the skeletal form, the overwhelming sense we get from the mountains of tags hanging. Moments of breakage, yes, and then mending. Are those the moments then that give us hope when we come to the exhibit?
There's a couple of things I think that have this potential for healing after. And I think for the viewer as well, this is something that has to be reckoned with emotionally as you're going through the gallery. So there's one that's a medicine cabinet that has glass bottles in it, and it's lit up, and it just, they're empty bottles, and they have a photograph attached to them. And that for the artist represents a kind of gaman, or a quieting of your despair. That, and this is the silence that Alan was talking about earlier, that this generational silence of the shame that's happened to your family, and being a Nisei or Sansei, asking those questions, what happened to you and what happened to our family, it just emphasizes the idea that silence is not consent. This resignation is not some sort of noble stoicism that's innate in the Japanese personality. This was survival, and this was a part of trying to live through this horrible thing that's happening to you and having some sort of hope that this wouldn't be forever. And then in the front of the gallery, you're greeted by a giant yellow daruma. And I am not good at, like, when I see the exhibit catalog, I'm not good at judging the sizes. So this daruma takes like four people, very strong people, to lift and put on its pedestal. A daruma is a Japanese wishing doll. So when you receive it, you paint one eye in, and then you make a wish or set some sort of goal for yourself. And when it comes true, you paint the other eye in. So everyone that comes in the gallery is invited to take a post-it with a daruma on it, make their wish or set their goal, do the one eye, and then put it somewhere on the daruma. So this is a crowdsourced interactive part of the exhibit that the artist Christina Iona is going to collect at the end of the entire run of the tour.
There's another kind. So I think Lane has described beautifully the different kinds of healing. There's another part of the installation that really speaks to me is a reproduction of an article that Ted Nakashima wrote in 1942 that was titled Concentration Camp U.S. Style. And this is a moment of not just silently enduring. This is a moment of a Japanese American saying what's happening in the language that describes what's happening, right? Almost immediately, although the government used concentration camp initially, they very quickly shifted to internment, which is a process that only applies to enemy aliens and was applied to about 2,000 Japanese Americans. The 120,000 Japanese Americans that went to the camps that are being discussed in this installation, none of them were interned. But in calling them internment camps, the government is euphemizing what's being done to Japanese Americans, suggesting that there's some kind of legality, some veneer of constitutionality in what was obviously an illegal and unconstitutional process. So I think it's important to see that aspect of the community too. Somebody standing up and saying at the moment, wait a minute, like, this is undemocratic, this is un-American.
What about the resistance or the speaking out against this on the part of politicians or other Americans? Was there a sense, did they know what was going on?
You would hope that there would have been more outcry, I think. In 1983, the Congress initiated a study to figure out what had happened. It's called Personal Justice Denied is the name of the report. And it concludes that mass incarceration happened as a result of racial prejudice, wartime hysteria, and a failure of political leadership. And I think that last clause, the failure of political leadership, is a pretty clear answer to your question, that there were people in Roosevelt's administration, including the Attorney General Francis Biddle, who said, we ought not do this. They were overrun, because I think it was easier, as Roosevelt imagined mobilizing a country for war, to sacrifice Japanese Americans and not spend the political capital to stand up for what was right.
And the trigger was Pearl Harbor?
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. Although I think it's super important to keep in mind the ways in which it's too easy to contain Japanese American mass incarceration to just World War II. That mass incarceration was just a consequence of Pearl Harbor. I think historically, to fully understand what happens to Japanese Americans during World War II, you need to understand a much longer history of a systemic racism that Japanese Americans and frankly Asian Americans had been facing since Chinese immigrants started showing up in this country, you know, mid-19th century. So, yes, Pearl Harbor is a trigger, but we shouldn't understand it as the cause, that the cause is much more profound and much more deeply written into the history of race in the United States.
And it's extensive as well, because we talked about the one artist that was from Peru, that the 2,300 Peruvian South American Japanese had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor, and they were deported to the United States, put in camps, and taught Japanese.
The government actively lobbied with Latin American countries to share their Japanese American population. And I think one of the things that resilience really insists upon that I think is so important is that, yes, Japanese Americans held on to some of their Japanese culture, but that didn't make them any less American, right? There is a real insistence that we remember them as Japanese Americans. When the government made its first documentary film to kind of explain to a largely ignorant public, the Japanese American population was almost entirely on the West Coast. Many people had never met a Japanese American. They were paying attention to other things. We know how that can be. The government made its first documentary film was called Japanese Relocation. And even the title immediately is reducing Japanese Americans to Japanese. Superman comic strips are doing the same thing. It runs throughout American pop culture and American messaging. So this claim that we always remember that when we're talking about Japanese Americans, we're talking about Americans.
We know that the exhibition opened on October 14th. With the times that you are there and people are coming through, what have you been hearing when you're in the gallery?
Yes, well, everyone who comes in is invited to participate in the Daruma Project, and so I'd like to read all of the post-its. Most of the students, you can tell because they're wishing for good grades on their tests and things like that. But there's a really lovely strain of people who are coming in and wishing for world peace, wishing for people to be recognized by the quality of their character and not the color of their skin. It's a really affirming way to think about our own horror at this American history, our own revulsion that this could happen, that this may happen again. And one of the artists depicts a Muslim woman behind barbed wire in solidarity with some of the actions taken against Arab Americans after 9/11, that this could happen again, that we should not descend down this road again.
And so I often teach another graphic novel to my students, George Takei's They Called Us Enemy. Takei, of course, of Star Trek fame, but wrote this book. And Takei is very much an activist. And he tries to make that point, I think, very specifically throughout it. He tries to juxtapose images that show young Japanese American kids saying the Pledge of Allegiance behind barbed wire, and then immigrant kids in cages in the United States in a more contemporary kind of setting, wanting us to contrast, I think, the ideals upon which our country is based and the realities of the ways in which we sometimes have fallen pretty tragically short.
Alan, we hope WVIA listeners know about your podcast with Patrick Hamilton called Pop Shop, where you talk about popular culture. It's a passion for both of you, and people can find it on the WVIA website. Tell us more about Superman.
Yeah, so Siegel and Shuster, the creators of Superman, second-generation Jewish Americans, who I think scholars have pretty convincingly argued are writing Superman as a claim to Americanness, a claim to the mainstream. Their comic strip in 1942, 1943 suggests that there's this large, well-organized Japanese-American plot from within the camps. They also sold off cartoon rights. So when you went to see movies in the wartime, you would see a couple cartoons maybe before the main feature came. And there was a Superman cartoon made by Fleischer Studios. It's considered to be very groundbreaking in its sort of aesthetic accomplishments. But one of the episodes in that series is called Japateurs, which, again, much like the government documentary, is blending Japanese and saboteur together as if they're almost indistinguishable. That if you are Japanese in any way, you are inherently untrustworthy. There's a brilliant, I mean, awful, but brilliant moment in the film where it lands its thesis very clearly. It starts with a Japanese-American man. He turns out to be our villain. He's sitting in a very American office building, and he's looking at the poster on his wall, which is the Statue of Liberty. Like, here, clearly, Erica is a person who is a 110% American. And then night falls, and he closes the blinds, and he pushes a little button on his desk, and the Statue of Liberty transforms to the rising sun.
And in those days, that would represent the Imperial Japanese Army and Navy.
And that's precisely the thesis of not only Superman during World War II, but almost all of the pop culture that's being created about Japanese Americans. That they're really put into this kind of catch-22 situation where the more loyal they profess themselves to be, the more reason for suspicion the pop culture is suggesting. Yeah, Superman does not, from my perspective, cover himself in glory during World War II in this way.
You do have events so often scheduled to coincide with these exhibitions, Lane, and we happen to have the guest lecturer for one of them.
Yes, Alan Austin will be giving a talk on Monday, November 17 at 6 o'clock p.m. That'll start with a little reception so that people can go through the exhibition before the talk. And then Alan will lead us in a little mini history, I think.
It'll be mini, I promise.
Of these events, and then we'll close with a healing craft event.
The talk will be focused on memory and mass incarceration. How we are going to remember mass incarceration has been contested from almost the moment the government started putting Japanese Americans into concentration camps. I think resilience is part of that conversation, and my talk will try to position the exhibit as part of a longer, some might call it a battle, I'll hopefully call it a conversation, about how best to remember Japanese Americans and their history during World War II.
Tell us how long the exhibit will be up again and where we find the gallery in the building.
Sure. The gallery is located on the second floor of Insulaco Hall at Misericordia University. The nearest parking lot is the library, and there's also elevator access on that side of it. You can see it until December the 15th. And if you come in at any time between now and then, please ask for a demonstration, because the students are prepared to demonstrate some of the interactive parts of the exhibition. And when you hear, for example, the yes-no vote, because it's a sliding wood panel that goes across the sculpture between yes and no, and when you hear that wood, that material is very powerful in terms of understanding how palpable that choice was, how grueling that choice was, how slowly and carefully they had to think about how they would answer that question. So please do come in and ask them to demonstrate interactives for you.
Dr. LaLaine Bagelin Little, director of the Pauli Friedman Gallery at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, adjunct professor of arts, film, and music there, and Dr. Alan Austin, who is an historian, and he has special interests in 20th century U.S. history, immigration, and popular culture. And they've been speaking with us about an exhibition titled Resilience, a Sunsei Sense of Legacy, that will run through December 15th at the Pauli Friedman Gallery on the Misericordia campus. And there will be a gallery talk and reception titled Resilience and Memory on Monday, November 17th from 6 to 8 p.m. And our guest, Dr. Alan Austin, will be the speaker. And he'll address the topic from concentration camp to campus, Japanese American students and World War II. And the session will conclude with a collage activity that promises to reflect on the past and resolves to create a better future. And that will be led by gallery director LaLaine Little. If you'd like more information, misericordia.edu/art, misericordia.edu/art. MISERICORDIA. Resilience, a Sansei sense of legacy, running now through December 15th at the Pauli Friedman Gallery on the campus of Misericordia University in Dallas.